old banjo didn't strung with twine. The only song I could sing, trouble on my mind. Trouble on my mind, boys. Trouble, trouble, trouble on my mind. If trouble don't kill me, boys, I'll live a long, long time. Live a long, long time, boys. I went down to Lynchburg town to get me a bottle of wine. They tied me to the whipping post and give me 99. Give me 99, boys. I went back to Lynchburg town to get me a bottle of gin. They tied me to the whipping post and give me hell again. Give me hell again, boys.
That's a little bit of Trouble on My Mind from Michael Cooney and his album Singer of Old Songs on Front Hall Records. Strangely enough, today my guest is Michael Cooney, a traveling musician for over 20 years. He's been helping to spread traditional and contemporary folk music through his performances at coffee houses, folk festivals, and on record albums such as the one we just heard. Local listeners will know Cooney through his MC work at the recent Philadelphia Folk Festival, sharing the stage with Gene Shea, WHYY's own Gene Shea. His television appearances on shows such as Sesame Street and his four solo LPs, which are his latest, Pure Unsweetened, a live family concert on Alliance Records, a children's album, Still Cooney After All These Years on Front Hall, Singer of Old Songs on Front Hall Records, and his folk legacy recording, The Cheese Stands Alone. Michael, I'd like to welcome you here today to our studios. I'm pleased that you've been finally able to take some time out to discuss your career and some folk music topics.
Thanks, Bob.
Perhaps you can tell us where it was that you first became interested in this music. You're from the West Coast originally?
Well, I was born in California, and I grew up in Arizona. And I really can't tell you exactly where I became interested in folk music, per se. Maybe I can. Oh, gee. I know that what turned me on to music, I always liked music. I really did like music. I took a piano lesson from Christine Higbee's grandmother when I was in the sixth grade. But she told Kathy Bull, and they made so much fun of me that I never went back for another, even though I loved it. I think the piano is the best instrument in the world, and I always regret that they did that. Anyway, later in high school, a friend of mine, Richard Diller, played the ukulele. I knew he played the steel guitar, but he'd been playing that for a long time, so it was just magic like all other music playing. But a friend mentioned that Richard played the uke, and we went over to hear him. And, hey, Richard, get your uke. Let's see it. Ha ha. And he brought it out, and he could barely play it. And he played Ain't She Sweet very slowly and hesitatingly, and I said to myself, I could do that. Stupid me, I could play that. And it was incredible what happened. I had to have it right then. I borrowed it. I borrowed his chord book. I went home, played that ukulele all weekend, and on Monday I went down to Stan's swap shop and got one exactly like a plastic ukulele with colored strings. And, I mean, that's what, to me, set off the bomb in my mind, and it never stopped after that. I just couldn't stop playing. And the Kingston Trio was at its peak. My high school already had a trio, but I couldn't wait to do the same, really. Also, across the street, this is what I was going to remember, that across the street from Pete Gallo's house, there was a little fraternity. We lived on opposite sides of the University of Arizona. There was a little fraternity made up of guys that belonged to other fraternities who just came over there to sit around and drink, and every Friday night they sang. And there was a guy who would go and play. He played left-handed, upside-down guitar and banjo a little, and he knew all kinds of neat songs. His name was Steve White. He showed up on the first Golden Ring album.
Hmm.
He was from Chicago, but he was going to school there, and he knew some neat stuff. And he really influenced me a great deal. He knew a lot of Josh White and Bob Gibson songs. And I remember being very impressed with him and learning some stuff. And I checked records out of the library. I remember that Pete Seeger came to town in 1960 when I was still playing a four-string banjo tuned like a ukulele. And I wasn't impressed. Or I wasn't inspired. I was impressed. I wasn't inspired. The guy was so great that it never occurred to me that I could play like that. That was just something beyond me, far beyond me. So I was impressed. Another friend of mine who was really a bass player, Bobby Kimmel, who later, he played bass behind my high school trio, and he later formed the Stone Ponies. Bobby said, "Don't you want to write to him and ask him about some of those songs he sang?" I said, "Oh, no, it's just too far away." He said, "You ought to write him." And finally, I did write him. I wrote him about a couple of songs, and one of them happened to be in the current issue of Sing Out magazine, and another one, he sent me something about it. And I asked him, "How do you become a folk singer?" And he said, "Sing for as many different kinds of audiences as you can for free." And I think that's correct.
Is that what you did in the early 60s? Did you find a lot of audiences out in the West, on the West Coast, or other
people? Well, I dropped out of high school in just before graduation and hitchhiked around. I came all the way out to the East. I went to Cambridge and just drifted around for a little while and got back in the spring. There was a group called Bud and Travis back then, a duo that played a lot of Spanish music. Well, Travis was from Tucson, and he just split up with Bud. And I had a second trio by that time. By the end of high school, I had a trio with two guys at the University of Arizona, and we were into much more interesting stuff. My first two trio mates didn't grow much, and I was really getting into more traditional-oriented and Weavers rather than Kingston Trio, etc., and they weren't. Anyway, I got together with my second trio after I came back. We had a big hootenanny in the park, 1961 in the spring, and Travis was there, and he liked us, and he said, "You want to form a group with me?" And we said yes, and we became, for a little while, Travis and the Good Guys. And we went out to Hollywood and started to make the scene, and I couldn't stand it. On the eve of our making a record, I quit. In the middle of the night, I just left. And went down to San Diego, where when I was hitchhiking out to Hollywood, I had stopped in a coffee house in San Diego that some guy that I got a ride from took me to, and met a guy named Grady Tuck. And I went back to see Grady because I liked his style. And we hung out together all summer in a coffee house playing from 7:30 at night until 4 in the morning. We were just a hippie band. There were about 12 of us. We'd stay up all night, have dinner at like 5 o'clock in the morning or 6 o'clock in the morning, and sleep all day, go swimming, get up at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, go swimming, and go up the beach to this coffee house, and all summer. And then everybody disbanded in the fall, and I drifted around and ended up in Colorado, where I met a guy named Ed O'Reilly, who was a student there, who taught me how to finger pick and frail the banjo. I really was just playing yugga dugga dugga ukulele style up until then. And Judy Roderick was a student there too, and it was a little coffee house called the Attic in Boulder. And I spent several months there, and there was a lot of good music there. Judy was learning, and Ed was learning. We were all learning, and people came through. That was a very heavy experience. That was only about 2 or 3 months, but it seemed like a year's worth of learning.
At this time, when you were drifting around the country, did you have any idea in your head about, you know, what were you doing with your life? Or was it supposed to be a time off so you could get your head together? Or what was it?
I was just following my whims. I was just drifting, really. I was. And having a wonderful time playing music. That's all I could. Learning everywhere. Learning everything from everybody. And I remember that I felt that I had found the place I wanted to be, that I knew that folk music would come and go. It was coming in, and I don't know why, but I knew it would come and go, and that I would stay with it when it went out. I just felt that all over, consciously. And there was something else. Yes, when I was in Colorado, I got a letter or a phone call from a friend of mine in Tucson saying he was starting a big coffee house, a big name would I come down and open it up? And he offered me so much money that I got serious. I remember that, too. I said, geez, you could make a living at this. Yeah. He offered me too much money, and I got serious, and then I started trying to get famous. After that, I went back to California, went up to L.A., and started hitting the hoots at the Troubadour in L.A. every Monday night and all that stuff. I regret that. I remember, and I went out to New York and tried to get... Took me a long time to recover from that. But I had a good time. I definitely had a good time.
In the late 1960s, you made your first record, and you Michael just rolled his eyes. I know
everybody hates their first record.
Right. There's no such thing as a good first record. It's impossible to do a good first record, or very, very difficult.
Yeah, yeah.
Very difficult to do that. And became somewhat of a fixture over here in the East Coast. Was there ever a shift away from trying to make it, you know, like the Kingston Trio and accepting the touring and the coffee houses? Is that what happened?
Well, there's a shift. There was a shift, but I think I always had a built-in thing against, I guess, as the more I saw people get famous, my friends around me, and there are a lot of people that I've seen go up from just beginning. Few of them are as happy as they were when I knew them, and I still see them sometimes, and I've always had a built-in circuit against... Well, I've had a built-in circuit against a lot of things, like I never could sing the same songs every night. One of the reasons I know lots of songs is because I couldn't stand those guys who came up and did the same exact thing every night, the same words to introduce. Now, I understand that a good introduction, it boils down to what you really need to say, and you tend to say it the same way every time. But these guys were like robots, and I never wanted to do that. And also, I wanted to be the object of mindless adulation. I saw it over and over again. I saw it when Bob Dylan was starting out. Now, he was great, and I really liked him and his music. But I didn't idolize him. It's like the wine. You don't worship the bottle the wine came out of. That's it came into my mind the first time somebody wanted to introduce me to him. Said, "Come to the party." I said, "I'm going to go. Meet Bob Dylan. I don't have anything to say to him." Anyway, I remember at one time I was Pete Seeger, and people would follow me off a cliff. And then I remember one time here singing for the Philadelphia Folk Song Society. I remember this very distinctly. I went out to do a concert, and after four songs, I felt like people were ready to get up on their seats, and I didn't like the feeling at all. And something clicked inside of me, and I started getting pedantic right in front of my own eyes. And I just calmed them all down, and I never did that again. I never was Pete Seeger after that. Suddenly it just didn't seem... It was like tricks. Now I see these performers at the festival, and they do these tricks. I can tell anybody how to get a standing ovation every night. It's not interesting.
I want to come back later on and discuss the whole... thing about being a musician, a traveling musician. But I'd like to go back to some more music and talk about kids' music after we hear this selection from your latest album that is called Pure Unsweetened Live Family Concert, which is an album for kids, and I assume you would say both young and old. We're going to hear some real kids' songs, a medley of real kids' songs from Michael Cooney.
Well, some of my favorite songs of all come from school, but not from the teachers. Songs that I've heard kids sing at school. I mean songs like "On Top of Old Smoky, All Covered with Sand, I Shot My Old Teacher with a Red Rubber Band. I shot her with glory, I shot her with pride. How could I miss her? She's 40 feet wide." Did you ever hear that song before?
Yeah.
I learned that song in Denver, Colorado, which is a long ways away from here.
And then I sang it once in Poughkeepsie, New York, and a little kid came up and said, "We know that." I said, "You do?" He said, "Yeah, but we do it different." I said, "How do you do it?" He said, "We use a green rubber band." And he was very serious. Well, there are so many really neat songs that kids seem to learn from each other and nobody knows who made them up, and yet lots of kids every place seem to know them. There's a song I've heard almost every place in one form or another, all about, "Mine eyes have seen the glory of the burning of the school. They are torturing all the teachers. They are breaking all the rules. We broke into his office and we tickled the principal. And truth goes marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Teacher hit me with a ruler. I bopped her on the bean with a rotten tangerine. And she ain't gonna teach no more." Now, you may know a slightly different version of that. I've heard, instead of bopped her on the bean with a rotten tangerine, I've heard him sing, "Nailed her at the door with a smoking 44, or "Met her at the bank in a brand new Sherman tank," and all different ways to do the same song. Sometimes instead of "We broke into his office and tickled the principal," it's "The principal got hot, so he threw him in the pool," or "I cheated the principal at a dirty game of pool." These are songs, see, sometimes they call certain songs children's songs, but real children's songs, and they're songs like that, grown-ups really don't like them. Grown-ups love children's songs, but they like children's songs that are made up by grown-ups for grown-ups. But, you know, grown-ups, we all sang them too when we were kids. We just forgot all about it. Here's a song that I know that I sang when I was a kid, and most people I know, grown-up people, did too. And kids are still singing it. But grown-ups do their best to forget that they'd ever heard it. "Did you ever think when the hearse goes by that you may be the next to die? They wrap you up in a nice clean sheet and throw you down about 6 feet deep, and all goes well for about a week, and then your coffin begins to leak. The worms crawl in, the worms crawl out, the worms play pinochle on your snout." There are some other verses, but I won't sing them right now. I did learn one in England that I liked. "The worms crawl in, the worms crawl out, they crawl in skinny and come out stout." And I've heard a bunch from my own kids about, "They use your bones for telephones, eat your heart, think they're smart," all kinds of stuff. Well, I like the songs that kids make up, and it's a real nice sign to me. It's because there's some great songs that kids make up after seeing things on television, especially after seeing commercials. There was a song that kids sang, 15 years ago that went, "I hate Bosco, it's bad for you and me. Mama put some in my milk to try and poison me. I fooled Mama, I put some in her tea, and now I have no Mama to try and poison me." And then about 6 years ago, I heard kids singing, "Comet will make your teeth turn green. Comet, it tastes like gasoline. Comet will make you vomit, so get some Comet and vomit today." And then about 2 years ago, they were all singing, "McDonald's is your kind of place. Hamburgers in your face, French fries up your nose, ketchup between your toes, mustard running down your back. I want my money back before I have a heart attack." But my favorite of all is one that I think got started by some kids in Boston, but it's traveling all around the country now. It goes, "Hold the pickles, hold the lettuce, shut up, lady, don't upset us. All we ask is that you let us throw it away." I think that's a good sign.
Michael Cooney, a pure unsweetened live family concert medley of real kid songs. Michael, I find that when you're playing for kids, it's hard to decide what really are what you think kids will like and
That's
what
right.
kids really like.
That's right. I think one of the most important distinctions is that parents expect you to sing children's songs. Kids do not expect you to sing children's songs. They make no distinctions whatever. Real folk may make no distinctions between folk songs and non-folk. It's just all songs. Kids, too. And I just had even more evidence. If you want a really good article on the subject, the introduction to American Folk Songs for Children by Ruth Crawford Seeger, a fabulous little essay on singing folk songs to kids. But I was at a festival in June where they did a novel thing. They said, come over to the children's area. You're scheduled for 1 o'clock. And I went over there to sing my normal stuff. And they had all kinds of crafts and neat things for kids to do. And they had no sound system, no stage. I said, well, okay, I can do this. Knowing that a lot of kids would just continue working at the tables. But they said, we want to do something, see if this can work. And basically, in a very short nutshell, they told us, first they sang the Itsy Bitsy Spider to establish the tune. Then they told a story, an African folk tale. Then they had people, everybody, tell it back to them in little, you know, short phrases, which they wrote down. And they said, now can we take this and make it into a song to the tune of the Itsy Bitsy Spider? And people gave lines and we worked on it until we had a two-verse song that basically told the story. And then they wrote it out and I sang it, or actually I led them and we all sang it together. And all that time, most of the kids were continuing to work at their, making their little things. They didn't contribute nearly as much as the grown-ups that were sitting around. Some kids did. Most continued to work. And a lady came up to me and said, several hours later, she said, you know, about an hour after you did that, I was pushing my kid on the swing, 4 years old, and I had watched him all through it, and he just continued to play at the table. And suddenly, about an hour after that, I was pushing him on the swing, and he looked up at me and said, Mom, what a great song. And then, a couple of weeks later, I ran into somebody who said, you won't believe this, but my kid was at the craft table making while you were doing all that stuff. And 3 or 4 days later at home, when I thought she hadn't even been listening, she sang the entire song. So it confirms what I feel. I go to sing in children's concerts, and grown-ups come, and they watch their kids for a reaction. And if you say something funny, they turn around and look at their kid. Wasn't that funny? Yeah, ha, 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 ha. And stuff like that, when I don't care if the kids are looking the other way. It's all going in. I don't like to go and do nothing while I listen. A friend of mine goes and makes quilts or knits or something. I wish I had something to do while I'm listening to music. And all you have to do is sing what you like. To get back to what do you sing, sing what you like. And I like to sing real kids' songs, a few, during a children's concert, mm-hmm. because they know that that's theirs, even if they've never heard that particular song before. It makes them feel legitimate. Those songs are about the things that worry kids, death and sex and violence, and grown-ups seldom talk about that. So kids have to deal with it, so that it goes into the songs. And I think to hear a grown-up even sing those songs is an acknowledgement that the death and sex and violence do exist, even though nobody ever talks about them. And I think that's a way to get them on your side. What did I put on my record?
I'd like for you to sing something now for us, another kid's song. Maybe...
Well, I'm always trying to keep my ears open
for
real kids' songs. I just heard a rhyme. Don't say ain't, your mother will faint, your father will fall in a bucket of paint, your brother will die, your sister will cry, your dog will call the FBI.
What would you do on, let's say, Sesame Street or Captain Kangaroo? What sort of thing would you, what type of song?
Well, I would sing Apple Picker's Reel or what did I do? Oh, old Joe Clark on the banjo, fretless banjo, or something like that. I know what I'll sing. Now, this is a different sort of approach. This is a serious song. It's almost over kids' heads. I remember the first time I was on Sesame Street, later I did a concert, and a little girl came up and said, she had these big white go-go boots. This is almost 10 years ago. Go-go boots and the little snappy-looking kid. But she came up and said, how did you get out of the television? There are real little people in there. Well, Malvina Reynolds wrote a song about Ireland and leprechauns, a cutesy little song. And I always thought it was too cutesy-sweetsies, like a lot of those dumb kid songs. And I think it embarrassed Malvina after a while, because she made Folkways Records stop printing the album, although they always keep all of their albums in print. I think she was embarrassed. It was her first album, which is my favorite of hers. Wonderful songs. And this was a little cutesy song on the album that Limelighters later recorded at The Little Land, all about Ireland and leprechauns. And one day I was driving down the highway and I had it on a tape with a bunch of other stuff. And it came on, and as soon as I heard it, I realized that Malvina didn't know it, but she wasn't writing a song about leprechauns and little people. She was writing a song about television. And every verse fits, and this is one of them. I love to sing at children's concerts now. In Ireland, the leprechauns abound. They'll dazzle you and promise you and take you by the hand into their little land underneath the ground. When you're in the little land, they fill your hands with gold. You think you stay for just a day, you come out bent and old. Dead leaves in your pocket, oh, my enchanted, have a care. Run, run from the little land, or you'll have dead leaves in your pocket and snowflakes in your hair. Lights shine in the little land from diamonds on the wall, but when you're out on the green hillside, it's cold pebbles after all. I think of those lights that go around on the game shows and everything. And if you're ever on a set after they're gone, it looks dismal and dull and dumb. Dead leaves in your pocket, oh, my enchanted, have a care. Run, run from the little land, or you'll have dead leaves in your pocket and snowflakes in your hair. You can spend your life playing, watching Monday night football and Tuesday night hockey and Wednesday night basketball, and wake up and discover that you've never done anything for your whole life, and it's over. When you're in the little land, you watch the wee folk play. You see them through a game or two, you come out old and gray. Dead leaves in your pocket, oh, my enchanted, have a care. Run, run from the little land, or you'll have dead leaves in your pocket and snowflakes in your hair. And Studs Terkel interviewed a guy and said, in his first book, he said, what did you do before you had a TV? And the old guy said, well, me and the wife, we used to talk about everything under the sun, and sometimes we played music. She played piano and I play harmonica. But after we got a TV, we never talked anymore and we never played any music. Music in the little land, it makes the heart rejoice. It charms your ear so you cannot hear the sound of your true love's voice. Dead leaves in your pocket, oh, my enchanted, have a care. Run, run from the little land, or you'll have dead leaves in your pocket and snowflakes in your hair. Now, the amazing thing to me is that Malvina didn't know she was writing that. There are other examples of that, too. And one of my consuming interests now is symbolism in songs, and where does it come from? Certainly lots of folk songs are very, very symbolic of psychological things that are not... It's not playing just to discover what it means.
What's another good example of that?
Well, the song The Briary Bush, or The Prickly Bush, The Maid Freed from the Gallows. It's a really ancient song. Someone's going to be hung, and in all the verses are very simple. I learned a version in England from somebody. I loved it. I never sang it because I thought it would be too boring, until I heard a friend over here sing another version at a party, and I realized it's a great song and I have to sing it, and discovered audiences really like it. I usually play it on the banjo, but basically you hear four verses and you've heard this whole song. Hangman, hangman, stay thy hand, stay it for a while.
I think I see my father a-coming over yonder stile. Father, have you brought me gold, any silver to pay my fee? Or have you come to see me hang on the gallows tree? Oh, no, I haven't brought you gold, nor silver to pay your fee. But I've just come to see you hang on the gallows tree. Oh, the briary bush, how it pricks my heart full sore. If I ever get out of the briary bush, I'll never go in it anymore.
And on, mother, brother, sister, true love. Now, true love generally says, yes, I've brought you gold, and now that I'm out of the briary bush, I'll never go in it anymore. Some versions end inconclusively, but most of them, he's saved by a sweetheart. And I thought for years, really, truly, what does this really mean? It's too simple on the surface. It has to have a psychological message. And I finally just hammered it out. I think it means I got myself into this trouble. My father didn't. My brother, my sister didn't. I got myself in. It says, if I ever get out of the briar, I'll never go in it, implying that I did choose to go in it. It means, on a grand scale, you're the cause of most of your problems, whether you want to admit it or not, and you're the solution to most of your problems, except sweetheart. Now, if the sweetheart is a solution, I think a folklorist, Edith Folk, folklorist in Toronto, I asked her about that, and she said, well, it's also that, and there's several folk tales. One, it's pointed out that it's a maid, not a man, being hanged. She's being hanged because in some folk tales, she lost her golden ball, and that's symbolic, and we don't have to. And who took it away from her? Well, her sweetheart did, so her sweetheart gets her out. There's another level, though, that I think I'm very curious about. I'm going to start a column for Sing, not a column, but I'm going to get Sing out to start a department called The Worst Job I Ever Played. Just interview performers and say, what's the worst job you ever played? And I have two. And one is, I was paid by a guy to audition in a hotel in Provincetown, Massachusetts on the 4th of July, I think in 1966. The guy paid me $25 to come down from Boston to audition. And I got there. He said, dress collegiate. I got there and I had on virtually the best clothes I had, which was not saying much. I did have an old corduroy sport coat and Levi's, I think. I didn't have anything more. And he said, I told you to dress collegiate. And I said, this is the best I got. And he said, well, I mean like gray flannels and blue blazer and tie. And I said, well, I'm sorry, I don't have any of that, and I never will. And he said, well, you're about my size. Maybe I can fit you up with something. He was about 35. He took me up into his apartment and got out these clothes, and he said, now, I want to tell you that we have four bars in this hotel, and you're going to sing in, and the one you're singing in is primarily a gay bar. So if you have anything that goes that way, and I said, absolutely not. I said, wait a second. You've just hired the wrong person completely. This is just not up my alley, and I really should not even do it if that's what you want. And he said, well, do the best you can, and we'll forget the whole thing after. And I opened for a woman whose whole shtick, billed herself as Eva Gardner, because 20 years or 30 years before, she'd looked like Eva Gardner. And the 20 or 30 years ago picture was out front. She weighed about twice as much. And her whole thing was changing the word you to yours in all of her songs. I saw yours last night and got that old feeling, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's funny for a while. It's the same thing. Okay, the substitution. What I'm getting at is, who is the sweetheart? If you substitute God for a sweetheart in almost any song, it fits. I don't know if it's true, but it fits. All those songs about come back to me, I'm so lonesome without you, and all that stuff. I don't know how I got onto that, but I started thinking about one today, and it fits almost every time. And I wonder about that. If you work on that long enough, absolutely everything in the world is symbolic. Everything.
Let me reintroduce you on that note. Michael Cooney is my guest here today in the studio. He has been, for over 20 years, a purveyor of folk music, both traditional and contemporary, and has performed in such places as the Philadelphia Folk Festival here locally and on Sesame Street on TV, Captain Kangaroo. This leads us into a discussion of what is folk music?
What is folk music?
Because if you ask the person on the street or in general someone who goes to the Philadelphia Folk Festival, they would say folk music is Tom Paxton, it's mm-hmm. Joni Mitchell, it's American, it's anything with acoustic guitars. And in fact, that's the way that Gene Shea, who does folk music with Gene Shea here on WHYY, defines it, in that way. And if you'd asked me, I would say, well, it's African guys beating on drums with sticks, you know, and people yeah. singing unaccompanied ballads or playing banjo, whatever.
Yeah. What is folk music?
What does it come to? The question I'm asking is, what does it come to mean today, and how do you define it for yourself?
For myself. Well, I have two or three definitions. One, all music is folk music. That's the easy one, and it's true. A person doesn't make up music that's not influenced by some other music, one way or another. But the one I like, I have a fairly conservative definition because I like what happens in the oral process. When somebody learns a song from somebody else, it hasn't changed. It still goes on all the time. I heard some guys singing a Beatles song one time in a coffee house. They sang Norwegian Wood, and they changed three words. And one made a difference. The line, "We talked until two, and then she said it's time for bed," had become, "She talked until two, and then she said it's time for bed." Well, I had a whole different image of the whole story by that. It was just a whole nother story, a different person. Everybody in the story was different. And I thought, if I heard that song that way and learned it, I might change other parts of the song to suit this new image that I have. And that's the essence of folk music. And I have two really good examples of it happening through kids. A friend of mine heard an 8-year-old kid in Kansas City singing that Bob Dylan song, "The Ants Are My Friends, Is Blowing in the Wind." And this kid was singing, "The ants are my friends, they're blowing in the wind, the ants are blowing in the wind." Now that's accidental. That's misunderstanding. To me, the really neat thing is when you hear a song, your mind changes it accidentally on purpose because you feel differently and you don't even know it. You sing it and you think you sing it the way you heard it, but really you've already changed it. A friend of mine's 4-year-old was singing in the bathtub and he heard her up there singing "Sweet Baby James," James Taylor's song, and she got to the line, "Deep greens and blues are the colors I choose. Won't you let me go down in my dreams?" It's a little abstract for a 4-year-old, and she was playing happily in the bathtub, singing happily, but singing about something that concerned her greatly, even if she didn't know it consciously. She sang, "Deep greens and blues are the colors I choose. Don't you let me go down the drain." That's folk music. Now, I understand that a lot of folklorists also are concerned with the process, and that's true, too. I remember Ken Goldstein at the University of Pennsylvania Folklore Department telling me years and years ago, I said, "What do you consider folk music now?" And he said something about any song sung in a small group situation for the entertainment of the people in that group at that time is a folk song. Well, I disagree. I Left My Heart in San Francisco will never be a folk song if people are sitting around the piano singing it, unless it variates, and it's not going to, because then somebody's going to say to you, "You better look in the book. You didn't get it right." But there is a process, and there is a big gray area. And you and I both know that in the end, it doesn't really matter. No folk ever worried about being authentic. They sing anything they like. I've heard records of Indians, or tapes of Indians. A friend of mine put it on one day, and it went on forever.
Sugar in the morning, sugar in the evening, sugar at supper time. Be my little sugar and love me all the way.
And there's no, it doesn't mean anything except when you hear somebody say, "I wrote a folk song," then I say, "Oh." Or Carol King in my local paper. Folk singer Carol King, it said in my local paper. She doesn't even play guitar. I don't know. That's my idea of folk music anyway. It happens over and over again. There's songs racing through now, the computer world, there's a wonderful song I just heard to the tune of Modern Major General. I built a better model than the one at Data General. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And everybody's passing it around. I don't know if it's going to variate because they're passing Xerox copies of it around. But the author is certainly... I happen to know the author, but the author is going to be lost pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Michael, let's go back to one of your recordings and then come back and talk a little bit more. Michael Cooney is my guest here today. We're going to go to his front hall album, Still Cooney, After All These Years, a 1979 release, and we're going to hear him doing a British ballad called Sir Patrick Spens.
The king sits in Dunfermline town, drinking his blood red wine. Says, where will I find a good sailor to sail this ship of mine? Up spoke an elder knight, sat at the king's right knee. Sir Patrick Spens is the best sailor that ever sailed the sea. The king has written a broad letter, signed it with his hand, and sent it to Sir Patrick Spens, who was walking on the sand. Patrick read, a loud laugh laughed he. The second line Sir Patrick read, the salt tears blinded his eye. Oh, who is this has done this thing to tell the king of me and send me out this time of year on such a wintry sea? Make haste, my merry men all, our good ship sails in the morn. Oh, don't say that, my captain dear, for I fear a deadly storm. Last night I saw the new moon with the old moon in her arm. Oh, let's not sail, my captain dear, for I fear we'll come to harm. Oh, loath, loath were the good Scots lords to wet their cork-heel shoon. But ere the game were half played out, their hats they swam aboon. And long, long may the ladies sit with their fans in their hand before they see Sir Patrick Spens come a-sailing back to land. Half o'er to Aberdour, it's 50 fathoms deep, and there lies good Sir Patrick Spens with the Scots lords at his feet.
Michael Cooney singing Sir Patrick Spens. Michael, I'd like to spend some time talking about the whole traveling musician syndrome or the whole idea of making your living out of folk music, which you've been doing for over 20 years. The first question that comes to mind is, how do you survive living on the road. How do you reconcile, first off, being
away?
How do you reconcile being away from a family? Because many people who play music, like yourself, have mm-hmm. family of some sort.
I think part of it is knowing that many other people do too, traveling salesmen, sailors, whatever, that you're not alone, you're not unique. It's what you do. Partly, also, it's what I've always done. What I've always done. I've never done anything but this. And so, it was no change. I mean, I had to go away from somebody all the time anyway, regardless of what the situation was. Ideally, you try to shoot for short, compact tours and long times at home. It's very difficult to do that when you're starting out. A lot of people fall by the wayside because of that. And there's... When I realize that I could make as much money staying home working in a store as I sometimes make on the road, it depends. I know I couldn't stand to work in a store. I don't know, you just do it.
Are the people that are still doing it and haven't fallen by the wayside, they have similar attitudes to you, that this is the thing that you do and you can't do anything else and you won't work in a store?
That's right.
But then how do you convince the family that that's okay?
The family, okay, the wife hopefully knew what she was getting into when she married this. Actually, they don't ever know what they're getting into, because one of the problems that surfaces is wives wait until their husbands get home. They can't wait till their husbands get home so they can go out and do things. They save up their going outs. Husbands get home and they don't want to go out. They don't want to go out of the door. They don't go. I'm home. I don't want to go out. I've seen a lot of. I finally resolved that. I've learned to go out a little, and my wife has learned to give me at least the first day or two to not go out of the house for any reason whatsoever. But then I'll go out and go over to the parents-in-laws for dinner and things like that. Kids, they grow up and it's all they've ever known. There's no... It's not like their father suddenly one day said, I'm going to go away for a few weeks. It's all they ever knew.
But can you give them then a quality parenting?
Actually, quality is more important than quantity. See, that's so... Sure. You can if you want to. I certainly know plenty of kids whose parents don't leave who have a terrible life. No, quality is what's important. Quantity is unimportant.
What about keeping healthy on the road and getting enough sleep and eating the right things? Is that something that you've in the beginning you didn't pay much attention to and pay more attention to now, or do you have certain routines?
I wonder. I feel personally that if you feel good mentally, you'll feel good physically regardless of what you eat and how much sleep you get. Almost. There are a few differences, but I've known that when I was not together mentally is when I got a cold every couple of months, and the flu at least once or twice a year and stuff like that. And the times that I felt wonderful mentally, I can just get by easily. An example is this last 2 weeks. I got very little sleep at Philadelphia. I worked all day, and then I went to the songs, sing-arounds out in the campground till the wee small hours, and all that dust and smoke and stuff like that, and the incredible heat. And I feel wonderful. And yet the weekend before that, I was at a folk music camp where we got almost no sleep. And we were having a wonderful time staying up singing all night and teaching all day, real teaching, and dancing and concerts in the evenings. And by rights, I should be dead. And yet I feel great. And relative to eating, no, I believe that you can almost... There are places in the world where people have almost single-thing diets, and those people live to be 100. I feel that there's a concern with diet that's out of boredom in this country, really. Boredom. I try to eat fairly well. I think about what I'm eating. I think about a little protein. I think about getting a salad every couple of days, I say, well, it's time for me to get a salad, and I'll go find a salad. A few things like that, try to get greens, but I'll never be obsessive about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not important.
One of the big problems that has been in the news a lot lately because of the death of Stan Rogers in a plane accident is the problem of being out there on the road and what can happen to you. You know, mm-hmm. the more miles you spend in a car or the more miles you log in an airplane, there's more chance that someone's going to hit you or you're going to fall asleep and go off the road or the plane will crash or whatever. Leon Redbone was in a plane that flipped over and mm-hmm. Nick Jones was in a very serious car accident. You yourself were in a very, very serious car accident, which...
Well, again, I think I have an unorthodox view of that whole thing. I have always been pretty fatalistic. If it's your time, it's your time. I don't care if you're home in bed, it's going to get you, sort of attitude. Everybody's going to have to... I don't see any problem with all of this. I think it's a dead issue, for me, a false issue. Every now and then, somebody I know is going to get in trouble. John Pierce,
yeah,
is in the hospital. He had some numbness in his arms. He thought it was arthritis or something, and he went in and they said they had to remove a disc from his spine. While removing the disc, they made a couple of slips, and now he's paralyzed on his left side or something. He's very little movement on his left side, and they admitted it was their fault. You can't protect yourself from that. It doesn't matter what kind of business you're in either. And same with driving. True, we do a little more driving than normal, but a lot of people have extra risks they take.
Right.
I don't think it's an issue at all. It doesn't. And I'll tell you one other thing. When I had my accident, I had been working for more than 20 years, and I was desperate for a year off. I always thought the gods gave me that accident because then I had an entire year lying around. I paid for it dearly, but I don't know. From the very beginning, it was an adventure to me. From the very beginning, I said, I never imagined myself inside an intensive care unit, and here I am. Look at all this stuff. Now, sure, I hurt. I guess I have a high threshold of pain, too. I did hurt, but there was always somebody to come around to poke something in my bottom that made it go away after a while. And sure, my accident first, and then 3 months later, I had to have a couple of brain operations, and I think on some level it worried me because after my first brain operation, I was an insomniac for about a week, and that's fear of death. You don't want to go to sleep because you might not wake up. But on another level, it was just very interesting. The whole experience was very interesting. And uplifting in a way, given the number of cards and letters and all kinds of support that I got. It was very good for me. Taking the pluses and the minuses, there are almost no minuses now, and a whole lot of pluses I'm left with. So what can I say?
I think you've said it all. What about, we just have a very short time left. What about any upcoming projects you'd like to tell us about? Any upcoming records or any big things that you're real pleased with?
Yeah, what?
Besides,
there must be something there.
Besides,
I have a million records in my mind. I have the covers all done. The only thing is it's very difficult to record. I hate recording. I'd love to do live recordings, but that's very expensive. I can't afford to do them and then sell the tapes. I can't afford to buy those fancy tape recorders and all that stuff. And none of the small recording companies is in a position to... So I wouldn't get it on the first night. I'd have to record myself over and over and over again until I get something that I'm satisfied with. Because I hate tape recorders. But if I have these... I have my mind full of records, theme records of different kinds. And I'm always thinking about that. What else is coming up? I feel that there's something going on in the folk music world. I was talking with somebody about that this morning, that something is changing, something's happening. I'm feeling much more excited about a whole lot of stuff. We didn't really touch on that, but over 20 years, I think there's a cyclical thing that happens. You get really enthusiastic, and then you go for several years, you go through the motions. It might be 7 to 10 year cycles or something. I feel that it's very long. You go through the motions, and your heart is not in it, and then after a while, you come back again, and I'm really excited, and I feel that a lot of other people are excited, and everything, a lot more places opening up, and people making great music, all different kinds. So I'm feeling good in general about all of that.
I'd like to thank you for coming down here today, Michael. Of course, with someone with your great experience and 20 years of performing, it's very hard to touch on everything in just a short space of time. And I appreciate you taking the time, and we'll have to do it again.
Well, thank you.
In another year or so. My guest today has been Michael Cooney. He's been a traveling musician for over 20 years, helping to spread traditional and contemporary folk music through his performances at coffee houses, folk festivals, and on record albums. Local listeners will know Michael through his performing at the Philadelphia Folk Festivals, his recent MC work there, his television appearances on Sesame Street, and his 4 solo LPs. We're going to hear one more cut from one of these albums, still Cooney after all these years, on Front Hall Records. And this is a version I thought very apropos to close with, Me and My Shadow.
Shades of night are falling and I'm lonely, standing on the corner feeling blue. Sweethearts out for fun, pass me one by one. Guess I'll wind up like I always do, with only me and my shadow. Strolling down the avenue, me and my shadow. Not a soul to tell our troubles to. When I go out at night with my old pal, we never fight about any gal, not me and my shadow. All alone and fear, the sun sets on the far horizon and the parlor lamps begin to glow. Jim and Jack and John put their slippers on. They're all set, but we're still on the go. So lonely, me and my shadow. Strolling down the avenue, me and my shadow, all alone without a thing to do. And when it's 12 o'clock, we climb the stair. We never knock, for no nobody's there, just